Hello and welcome to episode 9. I am your host MJ. Now on today's episode, I am joined by Elizabeth Gitari Mitaru, the managing partner at Ogolo. She comes bearing wisdom, I am telling you. She talks about the business aspects of running a law firm, things you should probably consider before setting one up, and what to consider when deciding who to get into business with. I hope you enjoy the episode, and if you do, please feel free to share, rate, and review the podcast. Now let's get right into it, shall we? So on today's episode, we are going to be discussing about the business aspects of establishing a law firm. And my guest today is an old friend. So I know she's reliable and she has her own law firm. She's been in the profession for quite some time. So introduce yourself.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. It's such an honor to be on the episode with you. Yeah. And as an introduction, my name is Elizabeth Gitari Mitaru. I have been in the profession for slightly more than 10 years and been admitted to the bar for 9 years now. And I do specialize in environmental and conservation law mainly, as well as a little bit of conveyancing and a little bit of public interest litigation as well.
Is there anything that you do outside the law?
Wow. I do find that a lot of lawyers might find that question a little bit difficult to answer, given how demanding the profession is. But I've also realized that a lot of the times when I speak to colleagues, I do find that what we do outside of the law more often than not leans towards the art. So I do love a little bit of creative writing here and there. I love running as well and taking walks in nature. Mm-hmm. And I have recently taken up crocheting, if you can believe it. I find for some reason it's quite relaxing. Mm-hmm. After a hard day's work, you know, going through legal briefs and cases and all of that, just having a cup of chai in the evening and getting to crocheting.
Oh, okay. So, you've said, you've been admitted for 9 years now. So
yes.
What has that been like for you?
It's been a journey of discovery, if I can say that. We have grown up in a profession or in an industry where knowing things and having the correct answer or even just having an answer to life's questions, to briefs, is very much respected. And a lot of advocates get out of school thinking that they know the law or they know themselves. And you realize very quickly once you get into the job market, as it were, that there are so many facets of law, and the practical application of what you've learned in school and that practical application working on client briefs sort of takes you through a journey of discovering who you are. And that's how it's been for me. So my thought process when I was in school, the things I thought I was good at, the things I wanted to do when I was in school are not the things that I think I'm good at now. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, what are some of the things that I would say that I would enjoy or be good at, I'd say I'm a very organized person, so I would probably enjoy admin work. And clearly, after 9 years in the profession, I have realized that I do not enjoy admin work at all. So yes, it's been a journey of discovery. I've learned so much about myself. I've learned so much about the profession, and there's still so much more to learn.
So I know you have a law firm.
Yes.
What is it you wish you knew before setting up that law firm?
Oh my gosh, everything. I wish I knew. Oh, there's so many things. The most important thing I wish I had learned at the very, very beginning was, I wish I had learned that running a law firm or being a partner in a law firm is actually a business, right? And you do go through certain courses, for instance, at the Kenya School of Law, like accounting for lawyers, where you're taught how to do your accounts. But there's so much more to running the firm outside of the accounts. Obviously, you want to get the money right. You want to get the accounting right. But there are so many other aspects surrounding running the profession as a business that would actually impact on how successful you are. Yes, knowing the law is important, and it's incredibly critical to be very good in your area of specialization and to provide value to clients. If you don't know how to run the resources that are coming into the business, you don't know how to manage the resources that are within the business, whether those resources are monetary or human resources or whatever type of resources, then you will find that you will be in the profession for 20, 30, 60 years, and you really haven't grown as a business, and you haven't impacted the industry from a business perspective. So maybe that would be the most important thing that I would have wished that I had known before. The second most important thing probably would be that a lot of your business or your clients will come from people you don't know. Especially when you're starting out, right? When you're setting up, when you're, you know, a young advocate, you haven't clocked 10 years or even 5 years, you haven't clocked 5 years in the profession yet. The people around you who you think are going to be your clients, you know, a lot of us think, you know, my relatives will come to me with their conveyancing briefs, or my mom's friends will send their work to me, or whatever it is. Those are not the people who are going to give you business. And a lot of the time, we do get into the cycle of rejection and then, you know, feeling like a failure, not picking ourselves up, because the people who have known us when we were quote unquote kids in the profession still view us through the lens of this is still a child. So take, for example, the way your mother views you today, whether you're 60, 70, 20 years old, 5 years old, you're still a child in her eyes. So if you're leaving the house from a house and you haven't worn a jacket, you know, she'll still tell you, actually, just wear a sweater. It's going to get a little bit cold outside. You're 30 years old. You know very well whether or not you're going to feel cold in the night or not, right? And it's the same lens that a lot of the people who see you growing up in the profession, that's the lens that they're going to view you, that they know you as an intern. They knew you when you were a fourth year in campus. They're not going to bring their briefs to someone who in their eyes is still a child in the profession. So do your marketing outside of the circles you think would bring you the business. 80% of your business, probably 90% of it, is not going to come from people in your immediate circle who you would call family or friends.
So that's quite good advice. That is quite good advice, because I remember even the very first episode we ever did was one on supporting your friends' businesses, and we're having the same discussion where my friend and I were talking about how even when most people start businesses, it's never the people around you that will bring you business.
It's and actually not, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's one of the things over time that I have personally learned to understand and be like, okay, I'm not going to feel resentful about some of these things, you know. It's something, yeah. So I do get what you mean.
And so, even when they bring their business, you know, further down the line, when they've seen, okay, you're a hotshot civil litigation lawyer, or you know your business in conveyancing or IP law, whatever it is, even when they come later on down the line and you give them a quote for legal fees, they'll be like, but we know you from when you were in diapers. Why are you charging us millions of shillings to do this work for you, you know? It's a double-edged sword. And the earlier you learn not to depend on that particular circle, some of them might come through. I'm not saying that everybody, you know, who you know is not going to support you. But don't put your eggs in that particular basket. Look for other baskets, preferably far, far away from home and friends.
That. Thank you for that. So now let's get into a bit of like we said at the very beginning, the mm-hmm. business aspect of running the law firm. What are some of the things you experience in the day-to-day of running a law firm that you don't think most people that are considering starting a law firm are thinking of at the very beginning?
I think the biggest sort of, let me use the word trap, for lack of a better word right now, the biggest trap that a lot of young advocates fall into is that the way the law and billing for the law is structured, especially with the advocate's remuneration order, and also in terms of some of the work that you might get, is that you get a lot of lump sum money, but that lump sum money is not everyday money, right? So you might get one or two clients in the month of January who pay you a total sum of, say, I don't know, 1.5 or whatever it is when you're starting out, right? And then you might go 3 or 4 months without additional work, okay? Mm-hmm. And the biggest sort of downfall is that a lot of guys don't know how to manage the cash flow in the business, okay? So you have a lot of stuff that you need to, a lot of expenses, obviously, that are going mm-hmm. Out of the business. But because you only view the money as, oh, I have 1.5 million in the bank, you now feel that it's time to buy a car because, you know, advocates should not be seen in a matatu anymore when they have 1.5 million shillings in their bank account. You need to go and now start getting suits from Little Red because, you know, how you look, you know, you have to invest in how you look, blah, blah, blah. You very quickly find that if you do not adequately manage the cash flow in your business, you will find that you have been paid for work that you now can't do because you're not able to facilitate yourself to actually do the work. So assuming, and this is pre-COVID times, pre-e-filing systems, let's assume you're in criminal litigation or civil litigation. A client has paid you upfront for the litigation, and probably you've negotiated legal fees per hearing, and they've said, okay, I'm gonna pay you the next 5 hearings up front, all right? You go to court the first day immediately after signing the client agreement, and after that, you know, you're given a court date 6 months into the future, right? Come 6 months into the future, you are nowhere near any amount of money. The 1.5 million, you've already spent it, you've bought cars, you've called your friends and said, oh, this, you know, I got a big brief, blah, blah, blah. And you're now unable to travel to Mombasa for the hearing, or you're unable to go to court for the actual hearing, right? So that's trap number one. Trap number two, when you're starting out, because you're hungry for the money, you are very quick to trust clients on their word, right? And you forget that the services you're offering should be subject to a contractual agreement. So I always advise that anytime before you take up a client's brief, have them sign an agreement with you or with your firm, saying that these are the services I'm offering, this is how much I'm going to charge you, this money is due in this particular tranches. If you're asking them for a deposit, say how much of a percentage is the deposit, when should they pay it, how should they pay it, what are they entitled to, when can they communicate to you, so on and so forth, so that you're not finding that you're fielding client calls at 1 a.m. in the morning and someone is telling you, but I've paid you and you're my advocate, right? Once you have a very clear sort of agreement, a contractual agreement, because it is a business and you're getting into a contractual agreement with your client, then you're very, you're at a position to actually refer your client back immediately you find that there's breach. The other thing is that a lot of advocates do not provide within those contractual agreements for their clients, for the opportunity for the advocate to fire the client. We always think that it's a client who's going to fire you, right? But there might be instances where you find that your association with a particular client is not very good for your brand. Mm-hmm. You are as an advocate, right? So you might be losing out on opportunities to earn higher fees from a different client just because you're associating with this particular client whose values you and your values do not match, right? The client is being toxic and is being abusive, verbally abusive to you. So for instance, if a client walks into your office, is abusing your staff, you know, calling your receptionist names, so on and so forth, then there is need to disassociate from such a client, and it's important to provide for such a scenario within the contractual agreement. The other thing is ensuring that, in as much as it's very, very painful, acquainting yourself with the taxes that you would owe, essentially, right off the bat. Because if you're making money as a business and you're not running at a loss, you must figure out a way of paying KRA and not have any arrears, right? Sometimes we might find that you have a 2,000 shilling arrears here or 4,000 shilling, and that's okay, but figure out a way of, you know, paying that off immediately and ensuring that you're in the clean books with KRA. Figure out what taxes are due. Are you paying income tax? Are you paying VAT? Are you paying, as clients supposed to be paying, withholding tax on some of the consultancies you're doing for them? Figure out what it is and ensure that you pay for those, right? I think the other thing that would be worth mentioning at the very start, when you're setting up, is knowing exactly what your niche area is, right? We're now living in the 21st century with all the sort of technological advancements that have come in. We are living also in an age of information access, right? So it's not like before, 20, 30 years before, where the law was very mysterious, you know. Nobody knew how to set up a company. They didn't even know where to get, you know, company seals or anything like that. You know, it was very mysterious, and advocates in that era were able to thrive, you know, in that environment. Right now, any advice you give a client, a very quick Google search is going to help them. We have Kenya law, number one. So if you start quoting sections of laws that do not exist, they're going to find out. There is accessibility to the information that you give and to the legal advice that you give to clients, which also means that there is very little in terms of quote-unquote advisory work that you can do in terms of traditional legal practice areas, right? So it's important to figure out what additional niche areas of law are coming up. A good example would be, we now have reproductive health law and fertility law, right? We have contractual agreements existing that sort of facilitate surrogacy, right? And facilitate adoption and the rest of it. And that's a really good niche area because, you know, it's high in demand, number one. Number two, it's novel in the sense that we still have instances where a lot of the legal know-how for that particular area is not very publicly available, right? We have biochemical laws coming up. We have so many other additional areas that are quite important and that are coming up, and people are actually realizing that they need legal structure for that particular area. So figuring out your niche is important so that even as you get the clients who quote unquote keep the lights on, you're still advancing in the profession in that particular niche that you've picked. And maybe lastly for that particular issue is drawing people to the sort of the hierarchy of law, or you know, the hierarchy in the legal profession, you know, where we call people who are admitted to the role before us senior, and guys who are admitted after us junior, right? So there's a lot of emphasis in the legal profession on experience, which means that you will not be able to build the same amount of money as someone who is your senior on the role of advocate. The only thing that's going to probably tip the scale in your favor when you don't have the experience and you're just starting out is being incredibly good in your area, in your niche area, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also figuring out a way of networking with your senior colleagues and being open to receiving guidance and support in some of the cases you get. Sometimes you might find that, you know, providence and God and fate and your experience and how good you are at something lands you with a brief, for instance, to appear before the Court of Appeal. Okay? Mm-hmm. And you're only, say, 2-3 years post-admission, you've set up your own law firm. The best thing to do in that particular situation is find a senior advocate who has had experience appearing before the Court of Appeal and asking them for guidance or for handholding to appear with you before the Court of Appeal for that particular. And most clients are very willing to pay additional fees for your senior colleague when you go to them and say, this is a matter and I'm looking out for your interest and it will really help your case if we have this particular advocate, excuse me, appearing before us. Their rates are X shillings per hour, or this is how much it's going to cost you, right? So those would be maybe the key things that I would probably highlight in that particular area.
Thank you for that. Now, as you were talking, one of the things I picked up was you talked about values at some point.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about now pairing, quote unquote, mm-hmm. your client.
Yes.
I remember you talked about values. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, are there things that you considered before taking on partners, and did your values inform that in any way?
Actually, absolutely. Absolutely. Let me tell you, I think the most important partnership in your life outside of marriage is actually going to be who you get into business with, right? And I did consider, let me say, key three things before I went into business with my current partners at the firm. Mm-hmm. Number one, and very high on my priority list, was integrity. I needed to be able to go into business with people who I did not have to constantly worry that we will find ourselves before a committee at the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission inquiring on mm-hmm. some of the things that we have been involved in, right? Because a good mm-hmm. example is this. All of the fraudulent land grabbing deals that you see across this city and across the country, mm-hmm. you can rest assured that there's a lawyer in the middle of it. And in mm-hmm. as much as it's not broadcasted, the legal profession is very small. We're a very, quote unquote, close-knit family. And especially if you're mm-hmm. practicing in Nairobi or in a particular town and you don't have like, you have associates and colleagues within your city of practice, and they know, they will tell you so-and-so is handling that brief, so-and-so, you know, took this money to be able to, you know, a lot of shabby business. And you do not want to mud or dirt your reputation because you've gone into business with people who do not have integrity. So that was number one on my list, that I needed to have the confidence that the people I go into business with are not going to drag me down, you know, 10, 20 years into the profession because of one, you know, corruption deal or whatever it is. So that was quite important. Number two was the issue of similar goals. So there are advocates who are satisfied with having, you know, a general practice, right? There are others who want to go into a large enough sort of continental presence or national presence, right? There are others who, setting up a law firm, it's just a stepping stone to get into the judiciary or somewhere else, right? And figuring out what your individual career goals are and how those two, those whatever number they are, if you're going into business with three partners, four partners, whatever it is, figuring out what your prospective partner's goals in life is or are, and seeing whether they match with yours before you get into the partnership, so that you're all pulling towards the same direction. And then the third thing, and the last most important thing that I looked at was, what are the core strengths of my partners, and can they cover my weaknesses? All right. And this doesn't necessarily, this is two-pronged. Number one, in terms of different areas of expertise, you might find that one is really good at family law, you don't like family law, you're not good at family law. Another one is really good at conveyancing, you're not really interested in conveyancing, so on and so forth. But outside of that, and even more importantly than that, is the personality weaknesses that you might have as an individual. And this calls for a lot of introspection and self-awareness. You heard me say at the beginning of the recording that I do not like admin sort of duties. And this is very funny because I'm the current managing partner of the firm, and a lot of admin falls on my desk, but I've figured a way of delegating the same. You figure out what your personality weaknesses are, and you find people who are able to cover those weaknesses with their own strengths. And you make it very, very clear, and you find an opportunity to learn and to gel with each other and isolate, you know, your key strengths and your key weaknesses and as individuals, and how those strengths and weaknesses or different strengths sort of reinforce the support for the firm, so that if you're not good at human resource management, then you have a partner who's really good at it. If you're not good at talking to clients and bringing in and marketing and bringing in clients by verbally talking to them, then you have a partner who's really good at it, so on and so forth. And those were my sort of top three things that I really looked at when I was figuring out who to go in, into business with.
One of the reasons I have asked you this question before is because, you know, even us, as we go through law school and like Kenya School of Law and stuff like that, we also discuss some of these things. Where, like, even I have had somebody approach me and be like, I would like to set up a law firm with you, and I was like, what, are you serious? Well, at first I was flattered, but then now I drew me back and I was like, okay, the first thing I thought was the same things you've actually mentioned, not everything, but some of those things, like especially the personality, as well as, you know, like the personal strengths, like the way, even in terms of, like you've said, the areas of practice as well. So I do get your thought process up to that.
Yes. And let me tell you, as and I keep giving the analogy of a marriage, and the irony of it is that the things that actually bring you together will be more often than not the things that you're gonna fight a lot about in the business. Okay. So, for instance, let's say you're introverted, but your business partner is extroverted. So they're a people person. They'll, you know, manage staff in a very, you know, good way. They're really great with client cocktails and that sort of thing. And that is what attracted you to them initially, because you thought, well, I'm a little bit introverted. I don't like, you know, small talk and talking to people. I would much rather write you an email than meet you, so on and so forth. And you think, oh, this is a really good person to have as a partner, because then they cover that particular weakness. And then 10, 5 years down the line, you find that there's a lot of expenses being billed to lunches and dinners with clients. There's a lot of money going out on client cocktails or team building activities for the firm. And you're mm-hmm. like, why did we spend 1 million shillings on lunch and dinner this year mm-hmm. alone? Why? Why do we need to meet clients? You know? And you forget that that was the original reason why you actually chose this particular person. So having a very good sort of ironclad partnership agreement, number one, but mm-hmm. also guidelines and standard operating procedures for your firm on mm-hmm. how do we relate? How do we, short of having the normal quote-unquote conflict resolution clauses in the partnership deed, you know, at first instance it's going to be mediation by a mediator appointed mutually by the parties, blah blah blah, you know, the standard clause, right? Mm-hmm. Outside of actually having that, have a sit down, all of you as partners, and invest time into thinking out scenarios and providing possible solutions to those scenarios where conflict might arise. Put it in writing and review it at least every year, right? So that mm-hmm. you're able to figure out how do we solve conflict and how do we sort out some of the disagreements that we will have in the firm, short of just going to arbitration or to court and having a very adversarial sort of resolution to those internal conflicts. Because like it or not, divorce is expensive, and especially divorce from a business partnership, it's very, very expensive.
Yeah, I can. With that, now you see, when you guys were setting up the law firm, mm-hmm. that was a couple of years back, the 2 year period that people are required to have after admission for you to set up law firms, yes?
Yes, yes, yes.
But as of recent, mm-hmm. as of recent developments in the law, mm-hmm. that somebody can now set up a law firm, I think, straight up after admission.
Yes, yes, indeed.
I think this is a conversation that led us to us even having this episode, the conversation mm-hmm. we had over the phone a while back.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
So it means that most people, I know of people even who like got admitted, and right after they got admitted, they were like on their way to go look for an office. You know, maybe they've saved up a bit of money to now, like as in a starting capital, nini. And like a whole year later, I was asking, oh, how's the law firm? And they're like, they're silent on that. And mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I get why you're silent. It's because at the very beginning, you had this idea and maybe a romanticization of, oh, within like the first 2 months, we'd have already gotten clients. So I know these clients from where I used to work. Maybe it was like a high-end place, you know. Now I'm mm-hmm. gonna like, and you realize the you that was at that firm is not the you that is at your firm right now, mm-hmm. because the you that was at that firm had the backing of a name that had already been established.
Exactly. For years. Yes.
And then mm-hmm. now you're coming back to this other one, and now you're wondering, oh, why did those clients follow me? They weren't following you the first time. They might have been like, oh, you know, you're really good at what you do, but then mm-hmm. they're complimenting the firm, not you. It's mm-hmm. the brand name that they were following. So, like over time, there's been a romanticization of people establishing their own law firms. And as much mm-hmm. as I want for, okay, you want to start something. But then at the same time, I understand that I have come to learn how this profession in particular works. Mm-hmm. Sometimes mm-hmm. you have to learn from other people. And that is something I've accepted. And even you being my mentor over time, there have been times where you've sat me down, and I remember one of the things I remember that you told me once is you have to allow yourself space to make mistakes. And I think that was the first time that somebody had ever like, and I don't even think it's something maybe you remember, just having a conversation in passing and you're going through some of my work mm-hmm. and you're like, you have to allow yourself time to learn from your own mistakes. Because I remember I used to have a habit of, I have to do everything and then give you the work, as opposed to doing it in bits for you to review in bits.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if you remember this conversation.
I do remember, and it's such an interesting, you know, when you're telling me that I told you that you have to allow yourself to mistakes, it's actually a lesson that I learned from my own thesis supervisor. And he was so frustrated with me initially because, you know, I would wait for months and months while I was working on a draft. And he'd keep saying, Elizabeth, are you writing? And I'd say, yes, I'm writing, but it's still horrible. I don't want you to look at it when it's horrible. Mm-hmm. That's one example. The other example I can give from my life is like this admin work story, right?
Mm-hmm.
I always, let me say, maybe subconsciously knew that I disliked repetitive tasks and repetitive administrative tasks, you know, mm-hmm. replying to emails, you know, writing repetitive reports and that sort of thing. It's really mm-hmm. not something I really like. So for a very huge period or chunk in my career, I used to just ignore it. And I used to get into a lot of trouble. In fact, there are quite a number of people who you might talk to and they'll tell you, Elizabeth is one of the laziest people you will ever meet. Until I spoke to a career coach, and when we're going through it, they said, actually, your issue is that you dislike admin work, but you will never be in a situation where you have work to do that does not include even a bit of administrative work. So you have to figure out a way of dealing with it. And ignoring it is not a way to deal with it. So if you don't want to do it, then delegate it. If there's nobody to delegate it to, then just find alternative ways of dealing with it. Okay, so for instance, create a reward system for yourself. Tell yourself, and this is what I'm now doing with my position as managing partner. I tell myself, okay, so you have a lot of admin work to do. So if you spend the next 5 hours dealing with all the pending admin work, you get to reward yourself by XYZ, whatever it is, right? And then I look forward to the thing that I get to reward myself with, and I don't get to indulge in it until I finish. So in respect of making mistakes, there are people in their 80s and 90s in the legal profession who still make mistakes, right? We have, for instance, Dr. Haminwa, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure if you invited Dr. Haminwa to your podcast and you asked him, so, Daktari, tell me, have you made any mistake within the past 1 week? He's mm-hmm. gonna list quite a number, right? And he's our senior by so many years. And the thing about mistakes is you have to learn how to fail fast and fail forward, right? Never mm-hmm. fail backwards. And do not sit in the pool of doubt and shame and failure and feeling, oh my gosh, I've done such a horrible thing. Don't yield into that temptation. Mm-hmm. Immediately you realize that you've made a mistake, it's gonna cost you at some point. It's either going to cost you money, it's going to cost you an opportunity, it's either going to cost you a relationship or a friendship, it's going to cost you a client, it might cost you time, whatever the cost is, take it as, number one, the price you pay for having learned that lesson. Tell yourself that I have paid, let's say your mistake cost you 50,000 bob, for instance. Mm-hmm. Tell yourself, I have paid 50,000 shillings for me to learn never to XYZ ever again. Immediately you put it in that mindset, when you realize that I have paid 50,000 shillings and I could have used that 50,000 shillings to pay for a mediation course and become a certified mediator.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I've only paid it to learn this one lesson that probably it's only me who knows. And then that is sort of going to help you not to repeat the mistake. But even if you do find yourself repeating it, the most important thing is never, ever to fail backwards. Always mm-hmm. fail forward. What do I mean? Move forward from that particular mistake. learn from it, pick yourself up, and keep on walking, as it were.
Yeah, very important lesson. I think that was the first time I like went back to the house and was like, "What? Okay."
And I'm sure I do remember. I think it was quite a. It must have been a shock. But the thing is, when you're starting out, you're gonna make so many. Oh my gosh, so many mistakes. And that's why you actually go to pupillage after Kenya School of Law. And pupillage is literally being shown how to do things because you don't know. So even with your 6+ years of legal experience, the people who created the curriculum for you to become an advocate know that even with those 6 years of being in school, you still don't know how to do things and you need somebody to teach you. But even those 6 months are still not enough. You will still keep finding. You've seen the judgment that has been going around by Justice Kiage, where he ruled recently from the Court of Appeal bench, where he recently ruled that there was this advocate who made a mistake in drafting and asked for leave to file a defense to the appeal, which is actually not something that exists, on and so forth. And the judgment was that costs for the suit be paid by counsel, right? And that's a mistake that that advocate has to pay for, because the cost that to him as a law firm, or to her, I don't know who the advocate was, as a law firm, and not to the client. And it's a really expensive mistake. But once they've learned from it, the best thing to do is to learn, is to fail forward and to know, okay, well, next time, then I have to be a lot more diligent around drafting rules in a court of appeal matter. And advocates still practicing at the court of appeal are making the mistakes. You're going to make some today, tomorrow, and even when you're 60, 70 years old. Just learn from them and fail forward and don't wallow in the guilt and in the shame.
Now, as we wind up, do you have any tips for people who are looking to set up their own law firms?
Oh, wow. Is this for people starting out who want to set up law firms, right? I think the first thing I would say, which sounds very counterintuitive, is don't. Don't in the sense that I am not very sure that the 6 months you get for pupillage are adequate enough for one to know what the inner workings of a law firm really entail in terms of running the firm as a business outside of actually working on legal briefs. Okay. So the options are two. Number one, or three as it were. Number one, you find a firm, a busy firm. Okay. A busy firm does not necessarily need to be a tier one firm. Okay. There are very many third or fourth tier law firms that are quite busy in the sense of the amount of work they do. And especially the amount of work they do because they don't probably have the bandwidth to hire as many associates as tier one firms, which means associates there work on very many files that are go on different matters. So find yourself such a firm, even if it's not going to pay you the amount of money that you think that a lawyer or an advocate of your stature is worth. You know, commit to 1 year or at least 12 months with such a firm and learn everything you can about it, okay? Learn how to do the work, the substantive work, but also learn the procedural work. When you have clerks in the office who are going to the Ministry of Lands to do searches or to, sort out certain transactions, so on and so forth, go with them. It's not beneath you, all right? Essentially, know how the sausage is made. If you have clerks who have to go physically to certain offices to drop letters, to talk to so-and-so, to figure out go with them to those offices, find out what the actual process is, all right? The administrative part of the legal work we do.
Mm.
So for instance, if you're handling an immigration file, find out how those applications are made at immigration, who is talked to after this, how does it move, so the administrative part of it. Court filing and file filing at the registry and perusing a file. You know, you'll find a lot of people saying, I'm an advocate, I don't go physically myself to peruse the file. Go and learn how the sausage is made. So that when you get your own law firm and someone tells you, at Lance, nimeongea now so and so, or this and this, and they've told me it's 3 weeks, you will know whether or not it's a lie. You will know where the walls are and where the gaps are and what's not moving, and figure out a way of solving those problems. That's option number one. Okay, well, and still, while we're still on option number one, befriend your boss and be willing to have conversations with them on how they're running the firm, even if they don't disclose like the actual money they make or how they go about it. Just have a conversation with them so that you're able to get a glimpse of the back office on how things run, okay? Option number two is find a mentor who will sit you down through the actual process of A, B, C, D, E, F, of setting up a firm and running it as a business. That mentor should be someone who is willing to give their time for free, okay? So, for instance, for my time currently, I'm charging 10,000 shillings an hour. So it means that for me to give somebody 1 hour of my time, ideally, they should be paying me 10,000 shillings for every single wire, right? So find someone who is willing to give you the value of their X hours to mentor you, and figure out a way to give back to them as well. Because, quote unquote, there is nothing for free in this town, right? And even if it's not monetary, I'm not saying you call your mentor and say, I have a check for you. How much do you charge? Please, can I have a lunch with you or something like that? No. Just figure out a way of making, of reciprocating and being a good mentee. But that is going to take you longer, essentially because there's only so much time that someone else might have to run you through the actual setting up of the firm. And a lot of times you're going to go to them asking questions when something has gone wrong. Okay? That's one. And then option number three, find resources, courses, books, and so on and so forth to read and to acquaint yourself on how to run a law firm. There's a law firm management manual by LSK. There's a lot of things that it leaves out of that manual, but it's still useful to some extent. Find a couple of courses that you can attend. We are running a webinar towards the end of April on exactly this particular topic, how to set up a law firm and run it as a business. It's a series of about 3 to 5 webinars. If you're able, and they're actually quite cheap. Well, not cheap, but affordable. Let me use the word affordable. And so find the resources to actually learn these things and then apply them practically. So that would be my best advice to anyone who would want to set up something immediately off from law school. And also, you know, part of the course we cover, you know, business development and having a business plan and how to put one together that actually works, so on and so forth. So all of these things are really, really important when that's happening. But more than that, have somewhere where your expenses can be covered or cushioned while your firm is trying to break even immediately you start. There's nothing worse than a client saying to themselves, oh man, I think my lawyer is broke, because it drains all the confidence that they would have. You know, you and your client cannot have the same money problems, okay? At all. You have to figure out a way of ensuring that even if you're broke, your brokenness does not show. So figure out a way where your expenses, and especially your transport, your food, and your clothing. I'm not saying go to Little Red and buy a suit, but there are very affordable suits in town that you can get, that you can pay for over time or whatever it is. Find a way of making sure that you're presentable, that your office is presentable, and cushioning your expenses while you run the law firm in the meantime, for at least a period of 1 year. Whether that means talking to your parents, whether that means finding a side hustle and baking cakes and having somebody else sell them, and you, whatever it is, figure out a way of having that stopgap measure. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think just find a law firm, give a commitment of 3 years, learn how it's done, save your salary so that you can set up in 3 years once you have sort of gotten the wheels turning.
Wow, thank you very much. As in, I have had a lot of wow moments during this episode. So thank you very much for joining today. And also thank you very much for your input. And if you've had, they have a webinar that will be coming in April.
Yes, it's a series of five webinars. We are getting applications through info@ogo-law.com. So anyone who would like to do that, then.
I think what I'll do is I'll link that in the description or the show notes, so you can check there if you would want to know more about that particular webinar. So thank you very much for joining.
Thank you too. It was such a lovely conversation. It was very, very lovely. I hope to come on again sometime soon.
Inshallah.